Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to another episode of CCT Live, Cape Cod Times Live Facebook news broadcast, brought to you every Thursday at 9 a.m. I'm news editor Patrick Cassidy, and I'm joined today by reporter Doug Frazier. Doug covers the towns of Harwich, Chatham, fisheries, other environmental stories, probably most relevant for what we're talking about today, sharks. We'll talk a lot about sharks today, including the most significant movement at the state level so far from a funding for safety efforts for swimmers and other people who use the water here on Cape Cod in light of the burgeoning great white shark population here. We'll also talk about an emergency evacuation drill by the Woods Hole, Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket Steamship Authority at their repair facility in Fairhaven that you attended, Doug. And we'll talk about the latest on legislation meant to save the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe's land and casino hopes, as well as a posthumous honor for Yarmouth Police Sergeant Sean Gannon, coming up on a year since his death in a shooting in Marston's Mills. We'll then take a quick look ahead at a hearing coming up on coyotes. That's actually happening tonight, and we'll be covering that probably in tomorrow's paper. That's always a topic of interest here on the Cape. You can take a look back at our past episodes. Check us out on all our social media accounts. Doug's Twitter account, very active. Facebook, Instagram, all that sort of stuff. Doug, this Steamship Authority ferry escape evacuation drill was in Fairhaven on Tuesday, I believe. Was it, or Monday, actually? Is
Monday,
when it was.
Yeah.
You were there. What was this about, and what'd you see?
So they run through this drill once a year. They rotate between the vessels that they have. In this case, the larger vessels have a mass evacuation system that deploys very quickly. It's basically the side door on a on one of the larger ferries. If it was a real emergency, would sort of not blow off, but get detached and fall into the water and sink.
That was interesting. They give up on that door for the time being. It just pops off and falls into the ocean.
Well, as one crewman said, you know, like, that's the least of our concerns, retrieving the door.
If you're trying to get off a vessel, something's gone terribly wrong.
Terribly wrong, right? Well, so they basically have a system that's built by Life Rafts Australia, and that is used on about 360 vessels worldwide. And it is basically a set of carbon dioxide tanks that send pressurized gas into this vinyl tubing. It looks like what you'd see in a fun park, for instance, inflatable fun park. And it creates a slide that's a covered slide that goes down to a raft that can hold 128 people. In this case, it's an open raft. It's not the one that you might think of as being having a kind of tent for more of an open ocean thing. This is to get a lot of people off the vessel quickly. They go down the slide, and then in this particular system, they have canisters. They're kind of familiar to most people who travel on these vessels. They're canisters that look a little like depth charges. They drop into the water. The crew is trained to pull this canister around to the raft that's at the base of the slide, and then they open it up, and it opens up to very quickly, again, CO2 charge, opens up really quickly, and the people who are on the raft at the base of the slide transfer to that other raft. And there's, you know, four, sometimes six of these additional canisters on vessels, and they take the entire population of the vessel and crew and everything off in less than, 30 minutes. They're supposed to be able to discharge the whole boat.
And as we know, things can happen pretty fast at sea, especially in rough weather. But the big raft can take about 128 people. But as you said, these vessels have up to maybe 400 people if they're full up. So these extra rafts that are deployed are meant to take those extra people who are on the boat.
I think it's more than 400. I think there's like 600 on some of them, I believe. Yeah.
So again, something that they train on. This wasn't necessarily unusual that they were training with it. This the vessel this was on was the
The Nantucket.
The Nantucket. And it's also on the Eagle Island home in Martha's Vineyard and, and Nantucket, as you said.
Right.
And then some of the other vessels have some other systems on board. But as you say, this looks like kind of a fun park type raft, but it's sturdier than that. They said this is something that can withstand some
10-foot seas. You know, I mean, Nantucket sounds more sheltered than the open Atlantic. So 10-foot seas, and I think it was almost 50 mile an hour.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to be on anything in 50-mile-an-hour winds out on Nantucket Sound, but I guess
right. I mean, usually they're canceling ferries, but you know they have to. I think they've been tested actually higher than that, so they're. But this is what they're sort of rated for use.
And again, this has not been used in reality for a Steamship Authority ferry, although there has been an evacuation in recent years from a Steamship Authority ferry. You'll remember the Ayano went up on the Hyannisport jetty, 15 people injured. They had to airlift some of those injured people off, and then some other people were able to get off on their own. We're still waiting for the Coast Guard report on what exactly happened there. The Steamship Authority says captain mistook a pole and at the end of the jetty for the channel markers basically and went the wrong way. Some people are wondering how that's possible, but we'll find out maybe when the Coast Guard issues their report. Moving on here, we've been following the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe and their efforts to preserve land that was taken into trust for them by the federal government and build a billion-dollar casino project in Taunton. This has been a project that's faced opposition from neighbors in Taunton. It's faced opposition from legislators in other states, most prominently Rhode Island. And the U.S. House of Representatives Subcommittee for Indigenous Peoples of the United States took up this bill yesterday. It was introduced, a bill yesterday that was introduced by Representative William Keating here from Massachusetts, actually from Bourne. And this bill was meant to basically secure the tribe's land and trust. Again, it had been challenged by these neighbors in Taunton. They had won in federal court, and basically by winning, they had said that the tribe wasn't able to take this land into trust or have this land taken into trust for them. And this all goes back to a Supreme Court decision in 2009, and they've been talking about, quote unquote, fixing that decision because that decision found that if a tribe wasn't under federal jurisdiction as of 1934, which was when the Indian Reorganization Act was passed, then it wasn't basically allowed to have land taken into trust or wasn't, you know, didn't have the proof that it needed to have that qualify for that trust status. So they've been talking about a fix for that for a while. That was something the tribe always knew it was facing. And part of this hearing was talking about that carcieri fix, as they call it. But this separate legislation that Keating has proposed would just straight out secure the land for the tribe. So they had this hearing. Interesting enough, the governor of Rhode Island's basically attorney went down and testified. So that tells you how much of a big deal it is for Rhode Island, who thinks that this casino will be competition for casinos in Rhode Island, gambling interests in Rhode Island, and therefore they have a pretty significant stake in what happens here. They're against it. They don't want the tribe to be able to move forward with this casino because they see it as competition. Keating asked attorney, the counsel for the governor of Rhode Island, to kind of explain why they think that the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe shouldn't have the ability to develop a casino or have their land in trust. Essentially, he was looking, and the tribe has always looked to separate the two. They've looked to say, listen, the casino is one thing, but our status as a sovereign nation is at stake here, and that's a big deal on its own. So you really need to separate the two out, is what Keating is saying, and the tribe is saying. Keating's quote, nothing in this legislation grants the tribe special permissions or rights in respect to a casino, merely guarantees that the tribe is treated equally alongside other recognized tribes. Obviously, the casino question is really a state issue. The state has laws that are kind of dictating who gets a casino and where. So this is an ongoing debate. The tribe is in some pretty serious financial trouble. They've been getting loans from Genting Malaysia, which is the developer that's been backing the tribe. And those loans have more or less stopped, although Genting is supposedly still helping out with the lobbying and pushing for this legislation, which obviously if they get this legislation passed and the tribe is able to secure its land into trust, they can then move forward with the casino and therefore their developer would be happy and be able to recoup obviously their investment. But the tribe has been laying off people. They've been dealing with this. They're basically 400 something million dollars, $450 million, I think at last count, in debt to the Genting Malaysia. Although it really depends on if the casino is built, they pay that back. If not, then it's kind of a wash for them at least. Although a big deal for the community here on the Cape, and that's why we're interested in covering it. A lot there. You can check out Tanner Stenning's reporting on that. And then moving on to a story in today's paper and something that was on our opinion pages today. The Red Cross is set to honor tomorrow Yarmouth Police Sergeant Sean Gannon, who everybody will remember was shot and killed April 12th of last year while helping to serve an arrest warrant in Marston's Mills. This is an annual event. It's the American Red Cross Heroes Breakfast. Have you ever been to it, Doug?
Yeah,
It's quite a dramatic event. There's all these stories. Obviously, Gannon's story is something that's gripped the community over the last year. But when you read through, and if you go to the Red Cross's website, Cape Islands and Southeast Massachusetts Red Cross's website, you can read through some of these stories, and it's pretty amazing the people who they're honoring as heroes, what some of them have done. There was a rescue swimmer from Mashpee who was off the coast of Maine who saved four fishermen out of a life raft for the Coast Guard. Being, you know, a hero is kind of the job. But then there were other people. There were two guys who were in South Yarmouth, and their coworker, hard to forget this one, had his leg basically caught in a wood chipper and lost his leg, but might have lost his life if they hadn't acted quickly, you know, tied off a tourniquet and raised it to the right level so that they could kind of stem the flow of blood. And he's said that he really has them to thank for his life. So those two gentlemen will be honored. A lot of people being honored at this. Jeff Spillane, our reporter, talked to Denise Morency Gannon about the honor for her son, which is the Community Impact Hero Award that the family will be accepting in his honor posthumously. And she basically said, you know, he would likely be surprised to be honored in this way. He kind of just considered himself an ordinary guy. And after he died, I think a lot of people looked at the amount of volunteer work and things that he did in the community, and this makes sense. But he was also somebody who was pretty darn humble from all the sounds of it. We also have in today's paper, again, back on the opinion pages, Dara Gannon, who is Sean Gannon's wife, wrote up a piece essentially thanking the community. Dara Gannon has been very, quiet during this time, and you can only imagine what she's been going through. But she's just been somebody who hasn't stepped, you know, sometimes you have people who will, you know, step forward into the spotlight in cases like this, and she's stayed very quiet in the background. But she took this opportunity to really thank the community. It's a really moving piece, and would suggest, you know, everybody take a look at it. But essentially she was saying, you know, if you want to remember her husband, find a quiet way to show someone you care, like do something for somebody, you know, pay the toll for the person behind you. And she really reached out and thanked the community and talked about how she was proud to be from Cape Cod when she saw the amount of support that was there for her and for other people, including the police department and others in the aftermath of her husband's death. So definitely worth the read. Doug, you've been covering extensively the great white shark population off our coast, and you had a number of stories within the last week, the most recent being in today's paper. Why don't you give us an update? There was some real movement at the state level, and then there's been some movement locally on trying to protect people from great white sharks off our coast.
So the state has – it's not as though the state hasn't contributed money before. They certainly pay the salaries for the researchers who have been studying sharks for a number of years, including during a five-year program in which they've been tagging, and it's a population study, basically, that people are waiting to hear, well, how many sharks do we actually have?
Trying to get some baseline data there to work with.
Get a population estimate, which are hard to do for great whites, but in our case, we have, you know, I don't want to say a captive population, but we have a population that's attracted here to a very discrete area, and it means that it makes it a little bit easier to study. So, but a lot of the fundraising has gone on, you know, in the private sector, you might say, you know, with the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy raising money to pay for, spotter pilots, for tags, for things like that,
and they've been providing the boat for
the boat,
yeah.
And it's not an insignificant amount of money. It's a lot of money. So the But when it comes to the towns, they've been saying, look, we don't have the money to do everything that is going to be needed in order to, like, educate, protect, maybe potentially protect the public, maybe potentially detect sharks and create shark warning systems. You know, that kind of stuff requires testing. It requires technology that's not inexpensive. It's very expensive. So they've been asking for help, and primarily Senator Julian Cyr and Representative Sarah Peek have been advocating for help from the state. You know, the state came through this week with funding that of $383,000 for a kind of laundry list of things that the town submitted to the state a few weeks ago. Well, actually, it was in February, I believe, at a meeting with Lieutenant Governor Polito staff and some Charlie Baker staff and administration officials in Boston. And this is a list of kind of what you would think would be like the basics, but it's still expensive. Emergency call boxes, satellite phones, trauma kits, first aid equipment, stretchers, ATVs. It's kind of the things that make response, you know, happen in an expedited fashion, because, you know, you don't have a lot of time if you've been bitten by a great white. So,
and we noted that, I mean, these were things that may have been talked about before, but really last summer it came to the fore that some of these things were a problem. Communication in particular, they realized, you know, not that it shouldn't have been obvious before, but that these beaches are fairly isolated out in the seashore, especially, and some of the communication in getting, you got to get the person out of the water, off the beach, and get up to a place where your cell phone's working. So some of this is meant to address some of that communication issue right away, right?
Right, because the tall dunes or coastal banks along the Outer Cape, typically from from Wellfleet on up, you see a lot of those communication problems. And for instance, Open Cape just recently unveiled a plan to connect 10 beaches for $1.5 million. It's something that towns and the Cape Cod National Seashore are still, you know, talking about, but it's going to solve another problem. It links fiber optic cable to the beaches and provides not only like a communications platform, but also a platform for some of the technologies that you know, they're hoping to employ at some point in time for shark detection, for instance.
You know, like the clever buoy technology that we've been talking about, and you wrote a story about that as well earlier.
Right. So a private group decided that they would like to, you know, help out and create a sort of a pilot program of their own and find a beach where the beach officials or town officials or even the Cape Cod National Seashore would be willing to run a pilot project. They're hoping to raise $200,000. They have a GoFundMe site. They basically have, as of last week, they had about $40,000 raised, but they're hoping to reach a sort of critical mass, and then they believe there may be some larger donors who could sort of finish the deal or get close. You know, they're hoping to get two buoys. It's not a purchase deal. It's leased. That gives you an idea of how expensive it is. But part of the expense is that the personnel from Clever Buoy, or Smart Marine Systems is the actual company name, would come out here and live for like 3 or 4 months through the summer in order to just sort of tailor the system and get it. You know, it's an algorithm-based system, so uses sonar and get it so that it works here well. That's the basic idea, you know. And so that's certainly, you know, one step towards detection, and town officials have been sort of mum on whether they would allow that on their beaches or not. Wellfleet town administrator Dan Hort says he's still concerned about liability issues. He has an opinion from town council that says basically, you know, if you do anything, it opens you up to more liability There's some debate about that, you know, but he basically doesn't see it happening in town waters. Cape Cod National Seashore Superintendent Brian Kallstrom was, you know, open to the idea of this innovative technology, but he said, like, permitting is going to be a big hurdle for it. You know, there are a lot of permits to put a buoy in the water, and it's not just a buoy. There's transducers on the bottom, and there's some debate about whether it would survive in a really dynamic environment with a lot of sand moving around, a lot of wave action.
Well, and that's another thing is testing something like this here. Maybe it worked somewhere else. Conditions are different in different places. You have to test it. You have to get it kind of fine tuned to an area. There are those questions about liability, questions about permitting. Obviously, the counter to that by a lot of people is you got to do something, because we had a fatal shark attack last year. We had another attack last year. And it's going to start to potentially impact tourism if it's not already. And you, just from a public safety standpoint, you know, doing something is better than doing nothing. Sounds like this $383,000. Some of it is kind of on the response side. Some of it might go to, you know, well, again, the buoys thing might go to kind of more of the prevention side. You're able to get an alert from that buoy if you put it in a system, and it would be able to tell people. You know, could you string that all on the coast? Likely not. So you'd probably have to, you know, select certain spots. But there are people who have to deal with this. Surf schools came up, and you have a story in today's paper about some of the things that have been going on when it comes to surf schools. These are people who are you know, have businesses where they take people out in the water to learn to surf. That's happening on town and seashore beaches. What's the latest on that front?
Well, so back in November, Orleans decided that they were not going to allow surf schools there. Now, that's at Nassau Beach, which is one of the largest beaches along the Outer Cape. Their reasoning was that there was, well, what they called it, maybe it's a euphemism, they called it, I believe, dangerous marine life. They didn't really say sharks, which was kind of unusual. But
I guess seals have been known to bite you, but it's rare that you hear about it, and it's even rarer.
Usually it's because they're being fed for
the seals. We're talking about sharks.
But for sharks, they do have buoys there that are capable of picking up the signals from tagged sharks, and just as they do up the coast for most of the coastline, there are buoys there set up to hear tag sharks, and Nassau mm-hmm. does get a lot of, you know, they're one of the highest in terms of the numbers of sharks detected and in terms of the numbers of hits on the buoys, which means that there's a lot of sharks there that are just sort of staying there for an extended period of time, mm-hmm. you know. And so, you know, yes, there are sharks there. They decided, okay, maybe it's just not good policy for the town to encourage surf schools, so they decided to ban it back in November. But further up the coast in Wellfleet and in the Cape Cod National Seashore, where a lot of the surf school activity takes place, and it's a very popular activity, Wellfleet decided recently that the selectmen decided that they were going to continue the practice of permitting the surf schools, and so did the seashore, and basically. In Wellfleet anyways, Seashore basically said, well, it's kind of business as usual. But in Wellfleet, they were thinking, well, okay, maybe we should require either more insurance from the surf schools. Right now, I believe they're required to have $1 million in liability, and they were discussing maybe, you know, increasing that. And, you know, one of the surf schools said that they were going to add protection. So they're adding things like, shark shield to the boards, and shark shield is, I believe now it's called Ocean Guardian, is an electronic device that sends out a signal that the sharks find irritating. They have an electric detection system in their snouts, mm-hmm. and it just messes with that. And so there's been some scientific study that says it's effective at deterring great whites. Mm-hmm. And so they're going to add that, they're going to have trauma kits on the shore with the schools. They're going to have their instructors are going to be schooled in the Stop the Bleed training, which has been going on through the winter. And you know, so they're taking steps.
Yeah. You can see these different levels. That's kind of at the you know, business, but also personal protection level, where it's something on the actual surfboard or on the body that's supposed to either deter the sharks or make them not want to bite you, obviously. And then there's the kind of systemic sort of protection with the clever buoy. And then there's the response to an attack if it were to happen through communication and stop the bleed and things of that nature. But it does sound like, again, there is some movement. I think, again, there's some people out there who were hoping for, you know, to be faster. But the state money coming in, some of these towns kind of making some of these decisions in terms of what's going to be allowed and not allowed. And then just some organization among the towns in terms of dealing with the state money. They've got to figure out how it gets distributed among the towns as well.
I think they probably have that already figured out. There'll be a memorandum of understanding and it'll get distributed. And what Senator Sierra and Representative Peek were emphasizing is this isn't the last of the involvement of the state. They're basically looking at, you know, how to fund other projects that are needed as they come along. And so they looked at it more as the beginning of the conversation. I mean, the Cape does contribute a lot of tourist tax dollars to the state.
It's a big deal for the state. And again, you can see them maybe moving up the scale from smaller ticket items, as important as they are, to the larger ticket items, be it a buoy protection system or something more or robust.
So the buoy is going to be a detection system because it doesn't have the capacity to
Zap the sharks. Yes,
right.
Mistake. But detection could lead to some prevention of a shark attack.
And there are other technologies out there that haven't been explored that do things like emit that electronic signal that may have the potential to also deter the sharks from an area versus from a person or surfboard. It's just an expansion of that personal deterrent or protection system. You know, there's a lot of technologies out there, not a lot of science applied to them, but other areas that are quote-unquote shark hotspots have a mechanism to test these technologies. And, you know, at the Cape needs something like that. And this private project to privately fund a test of this particular system, which has been deployed elsewhere in the world and in California, probably is a, you know, a good start to see how you can test, you know. I mean, that's the problem, is how do you set up a valid scientific test in a dynamic ocean environment?
In the wild. Yep. Well, plenty more to read about in your multiple stories recently. CapeCodTimes.com/sharks has pretty much all of Doug's stories going back a bit. And some of the other kind of detection technologies, being drones and that nature, you've explored in previous stories quite a bit. So there's a lot there. Thanks. And there'll be a lot coming forward, certainly as we get closer to the summer season. There's going to be a lot to talk about and report on. So thanks for your reporting on that, Doug. I guess, predator, if you will, question is coming up tonight. The State Division of Fisheries and Wildlife is going to hold a public listening session on the coyote population management, coyote hunting, and coyote hunting contests. It's been a big deal recently. Powderhorn, which is a hunting shop located down the street from us here, has been holding a coyote hunting contest recently, and it's gotten a lot of response from a lot of people out there. That hearing is tonight from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Cape Cod Community College. We'll be covering it, and we'll have some more on that in tomorrow or Saturday's paper, so you can look forward to that. Thanks again for joining us. Tell your friends, share the link. Thanks for being here, Doug. Really appreciate it, as always. Feel free to reach out to Doug or any of the other reporters here with any story tips or ideas. All our emails are at CapeCodTimes.com. We're where news here on Cape Cod starts. Until next week, good morning and good luck.
Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.